Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Welcome to What's Eric Eating? Culture Map's weekly look at all things Houston bars and restaurants. I'm your host, Culture Map food editor Eric Sandler. I have Josh DeLeon from Underground Creamery coming up in a little bit. But first, I'm joined by my co-host this week. He is a Houston hospitality veteran and a co-founder of the Houston Barbecue Festival. Michael Fulmer, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Doing great. Curious to find out all about this Underground Creamery. What's that all about?
Yeah, I don't know either, but it's blowing up the internet. So we'll talk to Josh. We'll talk to Josh and get wait for it, the scoop.
Oh my God, there it is. Oh well, okay. It's Monday. You can get what's a day you can get away with that.
Yeah. All right. Let us dive right into the news of the week. Topic number one: Izakaya, a Japanese restaurant in Midtown, has closed. Its owners, the Azuma Group, which is responsible for restaurants like Azuma, Soma Sushi, and Katarobata, is converting the space into a new casual Southern restaurant called Josephine's that will be led by Chef Lucas McKinney, who worked in a variety of roles for Underbelly Hospitality. He ran the kitchen at Haymerchant for a little while. He was the chef de cuisine for GJ Tavern for a hot minute, and he worked in various roles at Georgia James, the upscale steakhouse. Michael, before we talk about Josephine's, let's take a minute to remember Izakaya. Do you have any memories of it you'd like to share?
I didn't really go that often. I mean, I remember the first time I went, I was surprised they didn't have sushi. And of course, I guess that was part of their lease agreement because of, what was it, Blue Sushi? There was a sushi place across
from it. Yeah, Bluefish, the Midtown staple that's been there for Bluefish, 25 years or whatever.
So they weren't allowed to serve sushi. So that actually, you know, of course, that drove you right to doing the Rabada and the other stuff that they did, which was interesting. You know, I remember actually Teddy Lopez helped get them going early on too, Chef Teddy Lopez. And,
you know, I looked back at sort of my initial coverage of Izakaya, and there was a lot of potential, right? It opened with Hori-san from Kata Rabada contributed some ideas to the menu. Philippe Gaston was the executive chef. He was riding high off of Cold Cove Bar, his concept within Haven, this farm-to-table restaurant, kind of a pioneering farm-to-table restaurant. And I think more than anything, what I'll remember of Izakaya is that it never quite clicked for me. That, you know, they had all these great ideas about the Rabada and the ramen, and then for a little, you know, and then a couple of years later, they rolled out soup dumplings. And they had these really great bartenders that did the cocktails. And I know it's been a home for some very talented Houston bartenders over the years, but it just never quite snapped into focus for me. And after, you know, I went a couple of times when it first opened, and then I checked in on it, you know, maybe a year or two later, and I was just like, this just isn't for me. It's no disrespect to the people that work there, but you know, that I think more than anything will be my takeaway, that it had a lot of potential and a lot of good ideas and a great pedigree, and it just never quite snapped into focus for me.
Yeah. A similar dynamic for me. I remember how hard Philippe was working when they first opened, and it just was like, it was just okay. A decent enough meal, but it was just like, I'm not going to come back here. And it became more of like the sort of watering hole for the Midtown area, which, you know, is not really my scene. So yeah.
Right. I think that's right. I think it kind of settled into a sort of middle age. It's like a happy hour spot primarily for the Midtown crowd. And that was kind of it. But I do want to talk about Josephine's just a little bit, because I'm really excited about this for Chef Lucas McKinney. I won't say that we're friends, but I've known him for a couple of years and kind of watched him rise, you know, alongside Chris Shepard in the Underbelly organization. You know, he was kind of a fringe Pacemaker Awards candidate. He never quite got the public profile to be a nominee, but the work that he was doing, especially at Hay Merchant, kind of in the latter stages of that restaurant's life, you know, he built a lot of fans in the food world for the work that he was doing there. And so, you know, he's a Mississippi boy. You know, he worked at some great restaurants in Mississippi, and then he came to Houston. And for him to get this opportunity is really exciting for me.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. To me, you can't have enough sort of, you know, Cajun Creole sort of lunch, low mid-price places. You know, we're not talking like tablecloth places. We're talking like things that you find in the whole Delta region that are so prevalent in, you know, Alabama, Mississippi, and particularly in Louisiana. And there seems to be a real dearth of them here. So bring it on.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, though, you know, I talked to Lucas. He's like, yeah, you can get a po' boy and a cup of gumbo from us, but they're also going to give people, you know, if you want a seafood tower, he'll make you one of those too. So it's going to have a kind of a high low aesthetic. You know, I was sort of kidding him a little bit. I'm like, so it's somewhere between Winnie's, you know, the very casual po' boy bar in Midtown, and Eunice, the sort of elevated Creole restaurant with New Orleans roots. And he's like, yeah, I'd say that's fair. It's somewhere in between those. And you know, those are two restaurants that I really love. And so to have something that sort of slots in between them that yeah, you and I could go for a casual lunch, or you take a date there potentially, or some other kind of occasion dining, that's very appealing to me. Well, let me get your take. I mean, what do you think about this kind of as a fit for Midtown with everything else that's going on there? I mean, they're going to be close to Cyclone Anaya's and 13 and, you know, all these other places.
Even if they were doing the same dynamic as Winnie's is on the other end of Midtown. And there's just so many people who live in that area. There's more than enough room for both. But if they're doing something a little bit more, I hesitate to use the word elevated, but, you know, it's a little more mid-range price. Bring it. I mean, so many people talk about embracing, you know, Gulf seafood and the huge bounty that's available to us in terms of shellfish and regular fish and all of those things. There's not like a whole bunch of it, you know, and so particularly for that area. And if they, you know, if they're able to brand themselves as this, you know, real kind of Houston identity, Gulf Coast, dude, they're right on the edge of downtown. They have all the access to all those hotels, to George R. Brown. You know, they could become destination worthy. You know, that's obviously in the long run, they got to make it work. But I'll be there when they open.
I like that Lucas is thinking a little more broadly, right? He's like, you know, so many Gulf Coast restaurants, the food is heavy. It's really focused on New Orleans. And he knows that food, and he can make you fried catfish with crawfish etouffee on top. But he wants to go a little broader. He said, you know, I want to do the Gulf Coast from Corpus Christi to Florida, and be respectful of more recent ways of immigration to the Gulf Coast. So, you know, maybe a Vietnamese dish or two, maybe even a Croatian dish or two, and just think really broadly about what it means to be Gulf Coast cuisine in 2023. I'm very excited about this restaurant. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, plus there's the rare dynamic in Houston of the sort of pedestrian friendly restaurant or restaurant zone. And, you know, go through Midtown, particularly on an evening, you know, near the weekends, and there's people all in the streets walking around. They're bouncing around. They're not necessarily going to one place and staying there. And so there's something to be capitalized on that.
Absolutely. All right. Let us dive into topic number two. You're the barbecue guy, so we need to talk about the Swinging Door, the historic Richmond barbecue joint that is closing just shy of its 50th anniversary. Michael, let me just, you're the barbecue guy, as I said, not to repeat myself, but what are your thoughts? What is the place of the Swinging Door in Houston barbecue history?
You know, restaurants in particular, but really, you know, focusing that barbecue places really become, you know, once they make it past 7 or 8 years, they really become part of the community. And what's the old Don Draper Lane about, you know, line about nostalgia? You know, it's delicate but potent. And barbecue falls into that nostalgic, you know, realm so strongly that people who grow up with it, they continue to go. And when they become part of the community, they continue to go there well into their adulthood and bring their families there. And with the whole wave of what's happened with craft barbecue, you know, the Aaron Franklin revolution and everything that's happened since then, like they didn't pivot and change that. They stayed to who they were. You know, it was a very basic Texas Trinity of, you know, brisket, sausage, ribs. And it, for me, it was like of a middling quality. You know, for me, it was like, that's quite the drive for me. Like, you know, I live inside the loop. Now, will I travel for barbecue? Of course I will. But I'd gone a couple times and it was fine. Did I need to go back? No. But I was always really happy to see that you see all the local people there and that they were part of the community. And that's like a beautiful thing. They don't need to change, you know, and it's 50 years and that's a long run. I mean, I know they originally opened to be a furniture place because they thought a big development was going to be there. It didn't happen. And the guy literally, he bought the building and he literally pivoted to go, I'm going to do barbecue. And I've never done it before. And guess what? If you've never done something before and you open a couple months later and become a barbecue place that lasts 15 years, you know, that's something to hang your hat on.
Yeah, no, I think that's all well said. I think, you know, its inner loop sort of comparison would be like Good Company, right? A place that was very well thought of in the 80s and even into the 90s that is going to do what it does and hasn't adapted its style to the new trends and still has a very devoted following. And, you know, I grew up out in Sugar Land and you know, I remember going to summer camp on way out on FM 359. Even into the 80s and into the mid 90s, that still felt like the country. You head out west on Highway 90 and you take that right, go over the railroad tracks, and it felt like another world. And obviously there's just a ton of development around that area now. And it feels much more suburban now than rural. And so, but it does, you know, it has this devoted following. They're a little bit quirky, right? They use pecan wood instead of post oak to smoke their meat. So it had something that was a little bit distinct about it. And, you know, your friend and mine, Chris Reed, the barbecue columnist for the Houston Chronicle, had this great sort of history of the place. They cleared out a nearby field so that oil company executives from downtown could land their helicopters there, you know, if they wanted to have lunch. Bum Phillips used to go there during the Love You Blue era, you know, on and on. You know, he learned, you know, his pit maker built the pits for Dozier's, the Fulcher barbecue joint that's historic in a similar way. He trained at Pappas Barbecue on Pierce Street in downtown. All of these things, all of these little elements that just tie it into kind of the larger story of Houston barbecue. You know, the Facebook post announced the closure and just hundreds of comments from people like, you know, I've been coming here for 40 years or I moved to the area 5 years ago. This is the first place I had Texas barbecue. You know, I ate there with my grandfather, whatever. All those kind of stories. And so you're right. Like, is it a destination barbecue joint? No, it hasn't. It hasn't been that for a very long time. Did it serve its community very well for 50 years and make a lot of people really happy? Yes, it absolutely did that. And so, you know, I think just for all that, thanks for the memories to the Swinging Door and, you know, best of luck to the owner as he heads into retirement.
Absolutely.
And then topic number three, I don't think we have to spend too much time on this, but I think it's worth noting that Pondicherry chef owner Anita Jaisinghani is a James Beard Award finalist for her cookbook, Masala, that was published last year. Michael, as I said, I don't think we need to dive too deeply into Masala. I don't think either one of us have owned it or cooked from it, but this is your opportunity to say something nice about chef Anita Jaisinghani.
Well, the fact that she, you know, staked out her zone right in, you know, in sort of the River Oaks district, like the upper Kirby, you know, not what you would call the typical place for an Indian place. And she didn't just, you know, just kind of survive and make it work. She's really thrived. You know, that place is like, you hear that phrase meatless Monday, you know, they are destination worthy for that. And they created this, or she's created this, Indian brunch that has, you know, just a really good vibe. The menu's wonderful and it gets a good crowd. People sit outside, you know, I dine there, fairly frequently And I love it. And then, you know, the whole bake lab that she has upstairs, you know, you have all this great Indian food with, you know, my, some of my Indian friends are like, it's not spicy enough. I'm like, well, you know, that's the dynamic and that's the crowd, but you go upstairs and they'll have like, you know, the chocolate chip cookies with the chilies in them and all the interesting things there, anything that, you know, brings a little more attention to her and gives her a little more success, I think is a good thing. She's a great part of not just that area, but of the Houston dining scene as a whole. And, you know, is worthy of such accolades.
No, I think that's all very well said. I mean, you know, you think about when that development at Kirby and Westheimer opened and it had Katsuya, this vaunted sushi restaurant from LA, Del Frisco's Grill. It had two restaurants by Robert Del Grande, all have come and gone, right? And Pondicherry, this humble little, you know, Indian cafe that's very vegetarian friendly and very eclectic and kind of marches to the beat of its own drummer, has thrived for more than 10 years. And that's a testament to, frankly, you know, Chef Anita's talent and her drive and her team's willingness to go above and beyond for people. And, you know, it's just, it's affordable. And I mean, is it traditional Indian food? No, but it's not supposed to be. You know, it's her interpretation, and she uses all this great, you know, locally sourced produce and proteins and supports farmers and advocates for great causes. And she's involved with I'll Have What She's Having, you know, in a kind of mentor role to, you know, a lot of other female chefs and restaurateurs. You know, she's a pillar of the culinary community. And the book, I mean, from everything I've read about the book looks fantastic. It, you know, it teaches you all the tricks about how to cook with whole spices, you know, how to toast them, when to incorporate them, in what order, and all the dishes you can make with them. So the book looks great. She's one of three finalists in this category. You know, she's been a best chef, semi-finalist, and finalist in the years past. Never quite took it home. So I really hope she wins this, because it would be a very nice feather in her cap and a worthy accolade for a very accomplished career.
Agreed.
All right, Michael, I'm going to say that does it for the news of the week. We'll be right back with our restaurants of the week. Stick around. Michael, for our restaurants of the week, I have two Tex-Mex restaurants to talk to you about. Let's start with Manditos. This is the casual restaurant from the owners of Armando's, just opened in Bel Air. You and I had dinner there recently. So let me just throw it to you. What did you think about our meal at Manditos?
First off, the restaurant is beautiful. I mean, it's not decked out in this crazy, super upscale kind of dynamic, but it's so distinctive from the light fixtures, the color schemes, you know, even, you know, what the waiters are wearing, the servers are wearing, you know, there's these bright colors that just jump out at you, you know, it's very bold without being garish. And it gives it a great identity and vibe to it. You know, it's very upbeat, good looking bar, and very comfortable too. So, you know, that's all like just a great beginning, nice patio that's covered. You know, so that in the, you know, the rare bearable, not, you know, when the temperatures actually sometimes drop at night in the summer, they, you know, that can still be a viable dining opportunity. And then it's Tex-Mex, you know, they're not going too far off from the norm here. They're doing their thing. You know, I thought the enchiladas were excellent. It was interesting. The fajitas, they came out on a plate, you know, for one, it wasn't like this big sizzling thing, you know, this big dramatic thing, and they were fine. You know, the beef was good. You know, we've talked so much about this, you know, before, like, you know, Tex-Mex just being this kind of really ultimate comfort food, you know, particularly for Houstonians. And I think they fit right into that vibe, that dynamic. You know, they've got a niche, and with, you know, with a name of already being in Round Top and then Armando's, you know, to some extent, you know, I saw it, what clearly was a lot of some of their friends or regular customers there, you know, already checking it out. And also the Bel Air, you know, we've also talked about this. Bel Air is becoming, you know, a dining destination finally, you know, and it's so well-deserved just for the community and makes it more exciting for us who travel to eat.
No, I would agree with all of that. I think, you know, we had chips and salsa and queso. We had guacamole. We had an enchilada platter with different enchiladas on it. We had fish tacos. We had, like you said, we had the fajitas. It's all good. You know, it all tasted good. It was an appropriate temperature. It looked the part. I think this is a neighborhood Tex-Mex joint. And to your point, you know, we're sitting there. We had just sat down, and then, you know, friends of mine who live in the neighborhood walked in with their son, and it was their first visit because they'd been, you know, they live nearby and they were excited to have something like that in the neighborhood. And there just isn't that much, you know, there isn't much in the way of Tex-Mex in that immediate area. They're still kind of stinging from the loss of Pico's many years ago at this point. So it's certainly a welcome addition. Armando's brings a reputation for quality. And this is nice because it's not, you know, Armando's is white tablecloths and a little bit more fine dining, a little more formal. This is come as you are. It's very casual. Like you said, it's very bright, very clean. It's, you know, it's stylish in its way, and it's very welcoming. And I think it's a perfect fit for that area. And I think it's going to do very well.
Yeah, we had great service. Our server was really, she's great personality, but also like hitting all the right steps and right notes and you know, just putting her own personality to it. It was really well done. And then it's pretty rare that I ever have a dessert after Tex-Mex, because good Lord, all I want to do is take a nap usually, you know, or I take half of what I've eaten home. But we had the opportunity to try their churros, and they were spot on, perfect, just crispy exterior with that like sweetness without being, you know, treacly, and just, you know, that soft creaminess on the inside, a little chocolate dipping sauce. It wasn't done in this like crazy fancy plating. It was really simple, but really good and satisfying.
Yeah, no, the churros were great. We also had a banana split that I really enjoyed. That's like one of those nostalgic desserts that just always hits home for me. So you're right. Yes, the very rare Tex-Mex restaurant where don't fill up on chips, save a little room for dessert, because the desserts are worth it. The only other thing is, you know, I had a house margarita that I really enjoyed. So I think the, you know, an extensive selection of agave spirits, tequila, mezcal, even so tall. And so they put a lot of thought into that aspect of their offering, and it shows.
Yeah, it's definitely, they've definitely, it's well considered in terms of aesthetic, you know, beyond the menu itself, the bar program, they're not phoning that in. There's places that can phone it in. They can just have very basic margaritas, you know, but they're already established. If you're new, you know, you kind of have to bring something extra to the game, and you have to consider your beverage program beyond the, you know, the normal two or three tequilas you might carry. And they definitely have done that.
Yeah. It's tempting to sort of compare it in a, it's not as good as A, it's better than B. Like, I think I'm going to resist the urge to do that, but I will just say that, yeah, it was a very impressive, it was impressive and a nice addition to the neighborhood. I'd go back. I think, yes, you.
Yeah, you can go back with Linda Salinas and get her to pick the bar apart.
There you go. And then for our second restaurant, I want to talk to you about Verde Garden. This is the new Tex-Mex patio bar and restaurant from the Kirby Group. That's the local bar group behind places like Heights Beer Garden and Holman Draft Hall. Let me just throw it to you. What did you think of Verde Garden?
Well, Verde Garden is, they've really taken that space over, and it's beautiful. It's really comfortable. You know,
we should say that the space is the former Grappino Danino space that was part of the Nino's and Vincent's complex. Just to,
right. And that Nino's and Vincent's was like, it was an institution for Houston. You know, I remember, you know, a few decades ago when I first came here, I think the first week I was in town, I got taken there and had lunch at Vincent's and then ate at Nino's a little bit later on. And it's one of those places that, you know, most people, anybody over 30 really kind of know about, but I don't know anybody, including me, who's dined there in like the last, you know, anywhere 5 to 8 years, really. It's just, it became sort of an afterthought. And so this is Houston, you know, we don't really preserve so much as move forward, but they really did preserve the space, you know, they didn't tear it down. And it's that rare spot that's got, you know, a fairly large indoor footprint, but it's got a big enough parking lot to accommodate it. And that company is just a monster. I mean, like, just they've got this whole dynamic of like, you've got this beer bar here. And when I say a beer bar, I'm selling it short.
Yeah,
I mean,
60, what do they 70 have? Taps.
And- 70 taps. I mean, it's just crazy. And, you know, this is, they've made some really clearly wise decisions about how they're going to deal with not only quality, but more importantly with volume, because they're going to get large crowds. And that's, they keep the bars, it's a separate bar. You actually walk into the adjoining room, you know, that's juxtaposed to that for your mixed, you know, your mixed drinks, your margaritas and your spirit drinks, base drinks. And they're not phoning that in, that's for sure. They had, what about like 8 or 9 of these industrial professional quality blenders. And, you know, we tasted several of the drinks and they weren't, you know, they were perfectly blended. They weren't, you know, what's the viscosity level was right there. It held the flavors well. I mean, this is a very well considered operation and they've clearly refined that to that, you know, they're able to replicate that in other places. And I think a big step for them is bringing in, you know, Teddy Lopez, the chef, so that the food isn't just this kind of like, oh, we'll get some passable bar food. It's really good. Like Teddy really understands cuisine. He understands menu design and how to execute that. And we had some really good, go ahead.
Well, you've given me a lot to respond to. So let me just react to a couple of things, right? The drink program, made to order frozen drinks, which means, as you said, they have a wall of blenders. They're not coming out of a margarita machine, so that they can use, you know, freshly squeezed juices. They can use quality spirits and still get that nice fluffy texture and get everything blended properly and have different options. You know, there's not just one or two frozen margaritas. There's, you know, I think there's 10 or 12 of them, and they can do a frozen pina colada and a, you know, even a mezcal margarita with chartreuse in it, which is frankly one of my favorite margarita variants. So, you know, to be able to get that as a frozen is refreshing, not to be too punny about it, but it's a nice change from what you see at most other bars. And that setup of the beer bar on one side, the cocktail bar on the other, will be familiar to anyone who's been to Heights Beer Garden or Holman or any of their other spots. Like that's been a very successful format for the Kirby Group. And talk about Teddy Lopez, you know, this is someone who worked for Ronnie Killen for many years and at every concept, you know, he can run the pits at Killen's Barbecue. He can oversee the, you know, the line at Killen's Steakhouse. He helped get Killen's TMX, the Tex-Mex restaurant, dialed in. And he brings all of that experience and all of that talent to the menu at Verde Garden. Now, what were a couple of the dishes at Verde Garden that you really enjoyed?
Well, things like he did an agua chili that, you know, it wasn't a ceviche. So it was like, it's made to order, and it was light. It was refreshing. It was delicious. You know, the enchiladas were good. I liked those too. There was a mole on one of them that was really delicious. And this is all going to serve well for, you know, this is principally going to be sort of a drinking environment, but it was a good looking crowd. A fairly smart looking crowd, but, you know, in a very casual atmosphere. I think what's interesting, and this is their, you know, one of the things that they do is they do counter service. There's no cocktail waitresses, there's no servers. It's all bartenders and food runners. And that's worked for them. And whether or not that, and, you know, in that space, in that environment, people have that expectation, you know, I think people will come around and be just fine with how it comes out, because it's not, you know, it's not this super fancy thing where like, hey, I'm paying a lot of money, I want to be waited on. I think people will be comfortable with that casual vibe. And, you know, with Teddy back there, that shows that they're committed to like having that food be good.
Yeah. Well, and I think the nice thing is it will have that bar environment in the evenings, but they're open for lunch every day. So it'll have, you know, noon on a Tuesday. It's just a casual kind of Tex-Mex-y lunch spot. And the nice thing is that being bar forward, the food's really affordable, you know, so you can get an order of chicken enchiladas for $10, you know, or carnitas for $10. So it's very affordable because the drinks kind of subsidize the food, whether you're drinking or not. that's to your benefit. So if anything, you know, with the big patio and the indoor outdoor aspect and being, you know, kind of drinks forward, it kind of reminds me of Taco Milagro. And
yeah. And of course it has that phalanx of, you know, everyone's got, you know, of TVs now. So it can be, you know, kind of like the sports thing too, without it being, I think the volume was either off or down. So it wouldn't be this overwhelming thing. I'm sure they can adjust that appropriately when the Astros make the playoffs again. So would I got, you know, that barometer, would I go back? I would go back for lunch and eat there. Absolutely. For the reason you stated, it's like affordable and it's delicious and parking's not going to be a problem. Is it destination worthy for like, oh, let's go have dinner there? You know, not in my eyes. It's going to be more of the drinking environment that's going to, hey, you know, while you're here, you can also get good food. You know, you can get decent food here. So that's the more the vibe that I see.
Yeah. And I think, you know, dinner, it's more of like a group thing, right? Like if you're a group of like six or eight, you know, you won't need a reservation. If they got plenty of room, you can sit on the patio, you can sit inside, everybody can get something that's a little bit different, you know, even vegetarians, there's plenty of options, and everybody can get their own drinks and it's counter service. So you all pay separately. It's very flexible in that sense. And I think, you know, that would be more of the dinner vibe for me than, you know, maybe a, you know, like a one-on-one kind of setting. But, you know, again, I think, you know, the food definitely exceeds expectations, and that's not a surprise with Teddy in the kitchen overseeing things. The drinks are great. They always are at the Kirby Group places. And so, yeah, I think I'd be happy to go back there for lunch anytime and, you know, make it a stop in the evening, because it is, you know, it's on West Dallas, and we keep talking about everything that's going on in that area, whether it's, you know, Muse that we talked about a couple of weeks ago, or Andiron that just opened, or Clarkwood and, you know, or Georgia James or Ben Berg's places that are coming soon. I mean, you know, it's all on this corridor, and so it's one more stop on a night, right? You can start or finish it at Verde Garden or hit it in between other places, and it'll be casual and comfortable and relatively affordable. So it's very appealing for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, that whole area is just so dynamic and so much, it's so much happening and yet to happen. It's impressive.
Well, and the property itself, I mean, you know, we should note, you know, Katami, the new restaurant from Hori-san is coming there soon. So that's going to be on the short list of best new restaurants of 2023. At least that's my hope for it. And then, you know, that's in the Nino space. And then there's all kinds of wild rumors floating around about what's going into Vincent's. And I hope to be able to confirm that pretty soon. But it's if the rumors are true, it's going to be very lively in that little corner of the world.
Yeah, it's, you think, like, have we reached saturation level on sushi, you know? And the answer to that is clearly no. And with Hori coming behind it, you know, like the quality is just going to be top notch. So yeah, it's really going to I think it's going to be a home run.
Absolutely. All right, Michael, I'm going to say that does it for our restaurants of the week. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a good one.
All right. And I'll be right back with Josh DeLeon. Hey everyone, just a quick heads up that the interview with Josh DeLeon features a little bit of spicy language. You may not want to listen to this one with your kids in the car. Thanks. I am joined this week by the owner of Underground Creamery, Josh DeLeon. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Good. Glad to be here. Avid listener of the show. Very excited to be here.
Long time listener, first time guest. Thank you. Thank you for doing this.
Yeah, of course.
Well, look, I mean, you're familiar with the format, so let's start at the beginning. I mean, tell me about how you first got interested in the world of ice cream.
Oh, me being interested in the world of ice cream to me became a vice. So I was very into lifting weights, and that was my treat to myself. So when your diet is comprised of, like, you know, chicken and rice and broccoli every single day, you get to treat yourself. And then you know, there's a bunch of accounts that review ice cream at the time, and I figured I'd take a stab at it too. So I went ahead and buy all the Ben and Jerry's, all the Bluebells at the grocery store, and started reviewing them on my my food page called Eats Gone Wild. That was supposed to showcase, you know, local local establishments, but since, you know, I, at the time I couldn't afford to eat out a lot, and yeah, ice cream was my splurge thing, and you know, eventually when you eat like what over 400 pints of ice cream, you figure you want to try making it yourself, and that's where I am now. So
see, you say that like it's such an obvious thing, but let me tell you, I've eaten ice cream all over this country, and I have no desire to make my own ice cream. Like I'm perfectly content to let other people make ice cream. So dive into that a little more deeply. I mean, when did you get to the point where you were like, all right, this is like, I've had some good, I've had some bad, but like, I want to try my hand at this.
Well, you know, as a consumer, you're always like, man, I wish this company would make it a certain way that you want it. I was just like, well, fuck that. I'll just make it myself. I mean, cause like, you know, when you ship ice cream from all over America, it's hundreds and hundreds of dollars. Like, you know, at the time, Jenny's was probably the most affordable one shipping wise, because they had a flat rate if you buy 6 pints. So like I had a lot of Jenny's before, and now before they opened up shop here. Yeah, it is just like, you know, like I was just like, man, it can't be that hard, you know. Well, and then sure enough, when you make your first batch, I'm just like, wow, this is not good. And then knowing me, you know, I'm just like, I can't accept this. I've like, you know, spent so much money already. I got to make something, you know, passable. And sure enough, my persistence got me to, you know, just keep making ice cream like almost every single day since April of 2018.
Yeah. What did you start with? Like the KitchenAid attachment or how did you get started?
I bought like a $40 Cuisinart on Amazon. And that's like, you know, that's like a wedding gift that no one uses, basically. So like I bought that on Amazon, then I go to Goodwill or like Salvation Army. There's tons of unused Cuisinart ice cream machines, because it's just, you know, it's like you have to freeze the bowl and then you make the base and you have to turn it the next day. So it's kind of a hassle, but you know, it's just like no beginner would drop like a $1,200 machine. Compressor machine, you know.
Yeah. So was there like a cookbook or where did you first get the recipes that you were using?
So one of my first shipments were from Ample Hills in New York. I think they're closing down. They had some issues with like new owners or whatever in New York. So that was like one of my favorite ice cream splurges. At the time it was like $100 for 4 pints. I was just like, oh, cool, this is so expensive. And then, you know, they had quality control issues at the time. I'm just like, oh, all right, you know, and I kept doing it. That was because there's some pints that were just really good. And some pints were just like, it lacked all the mix-ins and stuff. But yeah, so they put out a cookbook, which just like covered, almost everything. It's just like, cause I've tried all the cookbooks. Like I just compiled, what I do is like I buy a bunch of cookbooks. And I made every single one of those recipes. So, and I found that yielded the best results to me, particularly. And yeah, and every time I see a new cookbook come out, I would just buy it and like make stuff out of it. But yeah, the Ample Host cookbook is a good baseline. I highly recommend that one.
All right, so like you said, it's 2018. You're making ice cream.
Yeah.
When do you get to the point at which you like, cause I met you in late 2019.
Yeah.
And you were producing more than you could consume. Right. When did you kind of get to the point where you started like sharing it with friends and family to like, I think this is pretty good. I think I want you to taste it.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't long enough after my first shitty batch, to where I started bringing it to work. I wasn't selling at that time. It's just like, I was just making so much. Like I said, I was making, that was like my life every single day since I started. I was just like bake a lot and see if it holds up in the freezer, because like, you know, when you consume, when you buy, when you try different things, sometimes like brownies are really hard in the ice cream. So like I had to find, I had to do so much trial and error to get to make stuff like that. And then, yeah, I mean, like, you know, like I bought me a little freezer just to store all those pints. And then that's like, you know, I was still buying ice cream then too. So like, I had like a whole dedicated ice cream freezer just for and like my own stash that that I take a bite of and not eat, just to like, you know, just to try different things, have a baseline. So like the whole thing was just like, you know, it was me showcasing on Instagram that I was just like, you know, making all this stuff. And then you get DMs where it's just like, are you selling that? I was like, nah, it's just a hobby, you know? And there's enough of that. And your DMs are just blowing up. I was like, man, I wish I could buy that. And like, I look at my credit card statements and I'm just like, wow, I spent so much on the ingredients already. I need to make a return. So I started hustling it at work at the time. And then I stopped doing that at work because people started stealing it. And I just like, you know, at the break room, someone just came out of the supervisor's office where the ice cream was hidden. And a coworker of mine was just like cussing around. It was like, who the fuck took my ice cream? And then that's when I stopped. And then that was, you know, like a blue collar job. So I worked at Southwest Airlines. It's a blue collar job. I worked on the ramp as a baggage handler. So like for someone to be angry like that, I was just like, man, I guess my product is, you know, it's better.
Right. The point at which someone is willing, we've talked about this before. It's like, you know, it's kind of one thing to be like, you know, a backyard barbecue cook, for example, and serve it to your friends at picnics or family events and have them go, hey, man, this is good. But then when you start asking strangers to give you money in exchange for what you're producing, that's like another level. It's got to be because then you're in the world of, you know, commerce where you're competing with Jenny's and Bluebell and Ben and Jerry's and all this stuff. So it's got to be at least as good as that, and maybe better to get people to give you money for it.
Yeah, I mean, like at the time, it was just like I sold it for like so like in the very beginning, since like I don't have any culinary background or like I don't know how to game the system in the cooking world. So like for me, it's just like I use good ingredients. Using good ingredients in general just yields a better result. And I like, you know, big ice cream companies don't you know, they have to sacrifice something. So like for me, this is all I know. It's just like use good ingredients. You're gonna spend a little more on it. And that's what I do. Like, you know.
Well, and you know, talk about a little bit the evolution of your style, because, you know, I would say that, you know, all of your ice creams, they have like a flavor, right? Like, you know, chocolate, vanilla, labneh, whatever. They have like a crunchy component, and then they have like a swirl, like a softer element. So how long did it kind of take you to get to that point where you're like, they're always going to have, or they're almost always going to have these different elements in them?
So like, for me, it's just not ice cream. It's a complete dessert. So like when you go to a restaurant and you get like a full fledged dessert, you get like, you get your, like, let's say you go to Blue Door and you get like a financier, and then you have an ice cream with it and some sort of crunch, and then the drizzle of sauce. That's kind of like, what I try to do, but you put it in a pint, you know, cause like I said, I don't have culinary background. I don't know how to make it pretty. So I can, what I can do is just like pile a pint of ice cream full of shit. And I think, it yields like a, you know, it leaves the customer satisfied in that way. Cause like, you know, base, some sort of texture and a swirl. The swirl is mostly there for like, to offset flavors from the base, because like sometimes it's hard to like let the base shine. So you have to, find some sort of flavor to complement that, and then like bring it through, you know? So that's just like my little formula, for my ice creams. I mean, sometimes I figure like, you know, when I brainstorm with, my friend Jana, who helps me here in the kitchen, sometimes some ice creams don't need it.
Right. Like I had I just this weekend crushed a pint of the labneh with sour cherry, and that doesn't have the crunchy component. That just has the, the cherries and the ice cream, and it's very delicious. It's not a complaint.
Yeah, I mean, so yeah, I mean, and the what I find is my father, he doesn't really like mix-ins at all. So like there's definitely a market for folks who are purists, but that's just not my style in general. Like I take pride in my formulation of my base, just because it's like, you know, it's a very delicious base. Flavors shine through. It's a Philly style ice cream, so that means there's no eggs in it. So like with the lack of eggs, you can really infuse the ice cream, and you don't get that eggy flavor when you churn it.
Right, and that does something for texture too, right?
Eggs, to me, eggs are like the best emulsifier you can buy. So yeah, you know, if you don't use eggs, you use gums. I use locust bean gum and guar gum in mine, just to make up for that emulsification, and it gives you body. So like, it is a at the end of the day, like Underground Creamery is like mostly on pints. So when people savor it and they go in and out of the freezer all the time, it keeps integrity longer than a lot of products.
All right, so let me circle back with you on the history of Underground Creamery, because I, like I said, I encountered you in sort of late 2019, and I started following you, and eventually I DM'd you and said, what do you do with all this? You're making too much ice cream, eat it by yourself. What do you do with it? And you sent me back a Google Doc that had an inventory, and that was ruinous for me. That sent me down a dark path of buying your ice cream. But word gets around, right? I wasn't the only one. Talk to me about kind of the evolution of growing this business and building your reputation and getting to the point where you joined a commercial kitchen space with Emmanuel Chavez.
Oh yeah. All right. I mean, so yeah, the Google Docs, it's one of those things where it's just like, it's, you know, you kind of have to devise something where you funnel, you kind of have to devise something where you have everything uploaded or something, because you get so much DMs of what you got, you kind of get tired about it. For me, like up to this point, it's like finding ways to condense that process. So at first it was just like, you know, Instagram DMs, and then you know, have strangers come to my apartment and pick it up, and then, you know, just I had this little secret Google Doc where I just post my inventory, and then I can actually it's actually live. So like, if you go, let's say I had like 10 cookies and cream or whatever, and so I sold one, that would go to nine. And then everyone who's looking at the Google Doc can see that. Yeah. And then, you know, it's like when you sit down on a Friday night, you just it literally took me 30 minutes taking orders, just because it's like, you know, I put a list down or whatever, and you know, I did that for a while, and then I started doing pop-ups. And I think 2019 I did the Big Bao Battle. That was like a huge event, and that's where I met a bunch of like industry people that you know, like Culture Map nominated. Like you have Gabe there, you have from Click, and then Willett and Jane. Yeah, I met all those guys there, and then I didn't think I was going to do something like that again. And until, you know, through the pandemic, I got convinced to do another pop-up, because like really during the pandemic is when my little hustle took off, because everything was closed, and then my DMs just started blowing up at that point. It was just like, I can't, you know, I'm doing what I can. I have a little machine, and I'm making it out of my house. So like, and you have to be discreet, because like, you know, I didn't really solicit it online, because it is like, you know, it is dairy, a dairy product
Right,
and a
right. We
frozen
should
product.
say just to sort of clarify, right, that there's something called the cottage law in Texas, and that covers mostly bakers, right? But if you sell something that has to be refrigerated or like ice cream frozen, that is not under cottage law. You have to have a food handler's permit, and
Yeah, you have to.
there's regulations you have to comply with to sell that to the public.
Yes, absolutely. And then, you know, I mean, I was just like, man, this is kind of dangerous and sketchy, you know. But that's why, like, I never
Well,
made
yeah, and
that.
if anybody had gotten really sick from it, they probably could have sued you for, I don't know, it would have
Yeah,
been bad.
absolutely. Yeah, it would have been bad. Like, I was just like, man, I don't make enough money for this shit, so I got to be discreet. I only got to sell to people who I trust. And then, like, I was just talking like that to my head. I was like, because like I did get worried because it's like, you know, I was working at Southwest for $15 an hour, and I'm just like, man, like if I got fined, how much overtime I have to work? I was like, I had so much anxiety doing that, but like, you know, people didn't seem to care. So, and there was a week where I just like stopped selling, and then like again, the DMs never stopped. I was like, are you selling anything? Are you making anything? I was like, nah, bro, like. I'm out. I got to lay low for a little bit.
Right. I will say, as a former buyer, my attitude always was, you know, I recognize that this is not produced in a commercial kitchen, and if I get a rumbly tummy, that's on me. You know, it's yeah. Like I've eaten at taco trucks in questionable environments, and you know, roadside joints. It's like I understand that this could end poorly for me, but I'm yeah. You know, devoted to deliciousness, so I'll take a chance every now and then.
Yeah, I mean, even though I didn't have like the chef background, I did take the food handlers thing. So like, I did keep up with the cleanliness as much as I can. And then, you know, like people come up to the apartment and you know, they see a cat, and I'm just like, man, fuck, man, is that cat hair in there? I was like, but you know, I just kind of kept her. I just kind of shoot her away from where I'm producing stuff.
Yeah.
So the kitchen completely blocked off. My little tiny kitchen that you saw on Instagram for like maybe 3 years.
All right, so like you said, it sort of blows up in the pandemic. What convinced you? You know, you got approached about moving into a commercial space. What convinced you that the time was right to do that?
I got health department got called on me. So, fun fact. Yeah, so I did a pop up at OMG Burger. So it's a little burger shop in Sugarland. I was like, all right, you know, no one's gonna fucking come here. It's in Sugarland, you know. So I produced and made like maybe 200 little cups, so I can prolong it, because like the machine I was using was very small. It was two quarts at a time. That's like what four little pints that I can make each time. So like it was just like it was like all day and all night that I was producing for that little pop up, and then. You go to the pop up, you set up or whatever, and then the line was just wrapped around the whole shopping center. I was like, "This is crazy," because like you know, yes, I have like people hitting me up, but you never see. I never saw how much people really wanted to try my stuff, and then sure enough, and I was just like, "Man, this is cool," you know. Like my sister gave me a little branding thing for Christmas that year, just like as a joke or whatever, and then I did another pop up at. Flipping Patties in the understory, and then a week after that I was like, OMG Burger is calling, the health department was asking about you. I was like, well, shit. And that's when my paranoia tried to, like, you know, like it was just like my spider sense paranoia just tingling everywhere. I was like, all right, I gotta start the company, I gotta find a commercial kitchen to produce, because like, you know, this is some eyes are on me now. So, you know, that's the trigger point of when the company was born.
Yeah. And I mean, this was, you know, we should say, right. You, as you said, you were working for Southwest Airlines in 2020, pandemic, everybody stops traveling. You had some time on your hands. I mean, it was kind of like in some ways the timing was fortuitous.
Yeah. So what happened with work is like in the beginning of the pandemic, they cut our hours. So I'm just like, well, I'm coming in for like 4 hour shifts. So it's like, this is kind of pointless. So, I just like signed up for like the voluntary leave, because they were just cutting hours everywhere. So like, I just did a voluntary leave where they gave me some, gave me a bit of my hours. And like, I just focus a lot on making ice cream and like pushing it. And like it was just like, you know, it became like a little bootstrap thing. People coming in and out of my apartment felt like a drug dealer, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, it was very confusing. As a consumer, I'll tell you, it was very confusing for the security guards at the apartment complex. They did not. It was very confusing.
Yeah, none of my neighbors knew what I was doing. You know, I feel like my neighbors would have been relieved if it was drugs, but no, it's fucking ice cream. Like, you know, like people are just like, yeah. And I remember your sister and bringing your niece upstairs. I was like, why is there children in my apartment? I was like, yeah, so it's like encounters like that. I was like, this is wild. And like, you know, it was a little cash business. So like Venmo transactions were very rare because like Venmo cracked down on, side businesses at the time. So like, I was just like, wow, I'm slinging ice cream. I got a wad of cash. What the fuck do I do with this? Like, yeah.
So, all right. So you move into the snack club. Or you and Emmanuel move into the space in Montrose that gets dubbed the Snack Lab. What did moving into a commercial kitchen do for you in terms of, because you know, up to this point, it was more hobby than business, right? Like you could have walked away from it at any time. Like at what point did you kind of decide for yourself, like, I want to try to make a career out of this?
At that point, in all of this, that was the only thing that was making me money. So I'm just like, I got to take this a little serious. I'm sharing a kitchen with a very serious chef, and I want to uphold that standard as well inside the kitchen. So like our colleague Matt Harris linked Emmanuel and I up as far as like sharing the kitchen together at the old Black Labrador space. And then it was rundown kitchen. We had to clean it up just to make it operable. But yeah, I mean, you know, watching Emmanuel work in the kitchen, it was just us two most of the time, like how efficient he works most of the time. And then all the fucking Drake that's going around. So like, you know, having setting the music definitely helps with like the work environment. But yeah, I mean, it's just how organized he is. It's just like, I try to emulate that in order for me to work efficiently as well. So, I got away with like, you know, working alone most of the time, and producing as much as I can. And then, you know, Jana helped me at that time too, cause she was fun and employed due to the pandemic. And, yeah, we were just like, you know, stay 12 hours a day with that little machine until we got a bigger one.
So I guess fast forward just a little bit. I mean, now you're in, now you've got a dedicated space, you know, you're leasing from Pudgy's Cookies in the Heights. I mean, it feels like a real business now, right? Like this is a permanent thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, yeah, it is. Mostly because it's like, you know, there's like dedicated customers and following it, which I really appreciate. They're like all of y'all who, you know, buy underground. I don't know. It's crazy to me. It's just like, it's unreal, and I'm very grateful. But yeah, it's you know, like I have like real bills now, like paying rent and, you know, big machinery that I have to pay for.
I finally have employees. You have, I mean, it's like a whole thing.
Yeah, it's a whole shebang is what they say, I think. And then you know, and you know, it's like, you know, there's definitely room to grow, because like when you start a business from like from your house. Or like when you start something and you never intended to start, you're kind of lost, right? So like the last 3 years since 2020, it's just like me crawling my way up to my business having legs. You know, nothing is perfect as of now, but you know, it's a lot better than what it was, I think. And I think I feel like my product got a lot better from what it was too, because I have more resources that I can tap into.
Yeah, say a little more about that. You know, kind of your evolution as an ice cream maker. You know, kind of where do you kind of get these ideas for these flavors, and you know, give me an example of maybe a flavor that you've done recently that you couldn't have done 3 years ago because you hadn't developed the techniques to do it.
Definitely the cheese whiz, which is like, you know, people sleep on that flavor a lot, but it's like So most of my ice creams hit nostalgia, like, you know, American nostalgia, which is like Ben and Jerry's, but not really, because it's a little bit more involved than that. So the candied cheeses that I made for Cheese Whiz, it's a technique from the matzo toffee deal. So that's all. Yeah, the more you read and like learn, it's just like you can apply same principles to different things. So like you can do that with Oreo, graham crackers, Ritz crackers, whatever you want. And of course, like matzah toffee with covered chocolate. So yeah, you use that to for like your crunch or whatever. And then the fudge and the peanut butter part is like inspired by those little Austin crackers that you ate for snacks in school. The cheese crackers with the peanut butter inside, and then you drink chocolate milk. So that's where I pulled that idea from. And then, people love the Oreo stuff, and, cookies and cream, it's a top seller ice cream for a reason, because it's very nostalgic. It's delicious. You can't go wrong with it. It's like a safer choice between like whatever other experimental thing I make.
Yeah. This is sort of an absurd question, but do you have a personal favorite? Are there a couple that sort of stand out for you?
Good question. So like, so whatever coffee I make, with the roast of the week, is a fairly popular one. So I did one with Tenfold's E45 Pasitos. So it's like they do like a very unique fermentation with a coffee bean in Mexico, and that's what the folks at Tenfold roasted. And I did the slow drip, and I found it so delicious and very complex. So I used that. I used those beans to make the ice cream. And then I just studded it with like some dark chocolate, like a fruity dark chocolate, and Biscoff. So it's like coffee and cookies play on that. So then I think that was one of the best roasts of the weeks that I've ever made to me.
And then I know you get this question all the time, but how do you sort of balance your desire to create new flavors with your customers' desires to like. Because you could make 3 C's every week and sell it, and people would be very happy with you.
Yeah. I mean, so like, for me, it's like the transparency that I have, and I'm like with everyone on Instagram, I'm very vocal about like, look, I'm doing this because I love doing this. And if I make 3 C's every single week, I'll get bored of it. It's not the time for me to do that, because like I want to keep the creativity. I wanted to keep it exciting, because it's like that's been my selling point since the beginning. So for those who like consistency, that's going to come once the business grows. But as of now, it's just like I want everyone in my customer base to know that we're mostly on the same page, but some people want that consistency and like the comfort of getting their favorite, but my space and my model doesn't allow that just yet. But it's definitely,
well, we should talk about that model, right? Because you, essentially you produce as much as you can in any given week, and then you put it online at a set time and it sells out in 30 seconds. And I would say my analysis is that changing the flavors every week is part of what contributes to that, that scarcity of, if I don't buy it right now, I might never see that flavor again.
Absolutely. And, it's like, it's kind of neat in a way, but because it's like, if I sell everything all at once, I have zero food waste as well. I know for sure, like learning from my peers around town, like, food waste is inevitable, especially when you go and fine dining, because people cut things a certain way, they have to be perfect, and I don't know what happens to the other thing. So like whatever I produce is like goes in every single pint, and then whatever excess that I have, I just repurpose it for the next week, and then I stock pudgies with all that stuff, and I used to do mystery pints, which is like, since I have more eyes now and people are prone to allergies, I have to be transparent, so I stopped doing the mystery pints. So,
yeah, it's a really nice symbiotic relationship that you have with Pudgies, because now you can, right. If people don't pick up the pints, if people didn't pick up the pints in the past and you were kind of stuck, now you can just retail them at Pudgies and move your inventory.
Yeah. Yeah. It's cool. Cause like, it's a good arrangement that we have, but like anything, people don't understand. Like if I start retailing it, they get a cut of it, because I don't want them to just be my outlet, because like I have to pay them to do that, right?
Right, so, right. Like, they're not going to do it for free. I mean, that's reasonable.
And I don't want them to do it for free because, like, that's not how business works. You know, when you are in a very symbiotic relationship, you want everyone to win. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's a good arrangement. Like there's definitely less complaints when I started doing that, because, you know, like people that don't pick up, it's just like, it's either they don't reach out to me, or they reach out to me very late at night. And I just can't arrange that, setup because I'm going to be in production mode.
Well, and we should be fair. I mean, you're not afraid to be a little bit grouchy on Instagram. You know, you're not afraid to sort of fire back at or make fun of people who are unhappy about some aspect of this model that because they can't get exactly what they want whenever they want it.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, like, I spend a lot of time like relaying information. It's just like, here's all the information. It's on my website. It's on every single post. It's all over my Instagram. Like the information is there and all you have to do is read. I give you, I'm not strict on when you're going to pick up. It's just like, I have these specific pickup times because that's when I have my staff and, you know, I can't produce at that time because my freezers are full. So, but you know, when the freezers are empty, you got to stock it back up again. You know, that's just the way it is just right now. Yeah, it's just growing pains as of now. It's like, you know, I'm very deliberate on how I grow underground because I do love it. I do love what I do. And I want to keep that excitement and creativity aspect to it, you know, because like there's plenty of great shops here in Houston. Like, you know, my ice cream friends make really good ice cream. Like, you know, everyone, there's going to be a style for you, but like, I'm deliberate about targeting a certain amount, like a certain niche, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, food nerds, yeah. Like restaurant dorks, essentially.
Yeah, basically. Yeah,
I know who I am. I've accepted my role in the world. So, I mean, you sort of alluded, like, you, I mean, do you have plans for, you know, larger production or that you could get to a point where, you know, it just is always available because you're making so much of it that you have, you know, say like four or five core flavors plus weekly specials that would rotate? Or do you like this? Or do you like this model that you're at right now? I mean, you could keep doing this for a long time, it seems like.
I mean, I can, but then again, it's just like, you know, having core flavors in a way, it's like a good marketing aspect because it's like, if you have that all the time and the core flavors are fantastic, you know, it's just like, it's going to pique your curiosity on what the rotating menu is. But as of now, like I said, you know, space and employees are not there for that yet, but I would love to have core flavors where you can get your three C's because, like, you know, that's like the most popular flavor that everyone wants, anyway, or your stupid animal cookie.
Right, right. I mean, right. Like, you know, if I think about, I've been eating, you know, Bluebell mint chocolate chips since I was in middle school, right? Or Ben and Jerry's cookie, you know, chocolate chip cookie dough or Cherry Garcia for a long time, like more than 30 years. So, yeah, if you could get to a point where you could, you know, you could make a, you know, roast of the week and three C's and I don't know. There was some roasted banana thing back in the day that was like mind blowing how good it was. You know, it's like, yeah, you could keep making that forever. People would keep buying it forever.
Yeah. I mean, when I started this, I wanted to do like the salt and straw model with it where they would rotate flavors each month and have core flavors. But like I said, I'm as of now, I'm like producing as much as I can. Like there's like, I don't see a wiggle room just right now, but like, you know, the more it grows, it's definitely in the cards. Like, you know, it's, I do like the excitement of the drops, but like, there's something about it where it's like, I feel like it's going to die down for a bit, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it, you know, we're 3 years in, it hasn't slowed down yet. Let me ask you about one other thing and then we can kind of wrap this up. But, you know, like you said, you're not a trained chef, but you have found a really nice niche kind of in the culinary community. And so I just want to ask you about kind of, you know, what it's been like for you to sort of be embraced by all these professional chefs and kind of, you know, have your niche in this world.
Honestly, it's kind of neat. And like the Houston chefs are like the most supportive people too. Just because I think anyone who starts a business in the food industry, it's like the bravery in that is like well-respected no matter who you are, you know? And then getting recognized by these guys is like a huge blessing just because it's like, I'm making ice cream, but it's just like, but I also dine a lot, you know, that's like my sub hobby where I love trying different foods. And then when you implement those experiences in your product, it's I think professionals recognize that. And that's a pretty neat thing in Houston culinary world.
I mean, it's fun kind of watching the, you know, it sort of spread, right? It's like, you know, you start making an ice cream for Neo, they serve it with caviar, and then Navy Blue opens and you know, Aaron Bluedorn and Marie Riddle are doing a caviar and ice cream dessert. It's like, yeah. I see you working, you know, not that you guys invented that necessarily, but like,
no.
but you know, you certainly showed that like there's a market for that in Houston. And so, yeah, why wouldn't Navy Blue put their spin on something like that?
No, yeah. And that's the thing too. Once I see like different people like making like very similar things, it just makes everyone better. And that's why I don't really gatekeep much. When people ask me online, I was like, oh, how you do this? I'll show you where I got the recipe. It's just like, I'm not going to tell you step by step because I do make some of my own tweaks in those recipes. So I'm just like, yeah, it's neat. And then, you know, Emmanuel had the masa ice cream for a while, but he said, I don't think he has room in his freezer anymore. So he's a busy man, you know?
Yeah. He's a busy, yeah. He's got a lot going on, that guy. That restaurant might work out okay. It seems like it's going okay for him.
Yeah. They got pancakes.
Yeah. Let me ask you about one other thing, right? Because we talked on the show several months ago about, you know, Ben Berg is opening, Benny Chow's a Chinese restaurant. There was a reaction in the community that there were things about that were problematic for people. You were very outspoken. You got quoted in the Chronicle, and so you kind of ran afoul of people who didn't appreciate you sharing your opinion. So let me just ask you, I mean, like, does that make you more reluctant to express yourself, or did you kind of come out of that experience just being like, if I have something to say, I'm going to say it. I don't care.
If I have something to say, especially when it indirectly affect like the people of my community, I'm going to say something because like I can't be for me as a business owner, like I can't be as neutral when it comes to situations like that. But even if it hurts my business, I don't really care. Because it's like those people, I don't need to deal with those people, and that's okay. And it's just like, you know, I'm not really afraid to speak out. It's just like, I'm not trying to like, you know, knock his business or anything. It's just like, oh, it's just one of those things. So it's like, oh, that's kind of fucked up, and you know, move on.
Well, because there are plenty of other people who are like, you know, the other perspective is, look, I've got to sell food to everybody, no matter their right. political opinion. And so right. I don't want to rock the boat. You know, I'm just going to keep my head down and do my job.
Yeah. And in that aspect, I'm in a very fortunate position where I can tell you to fuck off. And I'm just like, and you know, it to me, it's like, I'm very grateful that I have dedicated customers who aligns with my values. And I feel like your customer base will support you no matter what, you know, like really, like I will support anyone who aligns with my values no matter what. Plus they make really good fucking food, like come on, you know.
Well, and since you mentioned it, I mean, you know, that you do like to go out to eat and you have, you know, built this community, I mean, what are a couple of the places that you've been to that you want to give a shout out to that you're particularly excited about right now?
So I went to Andiron when they opened. Fire. Where else did I go?
But did you get the key lime pie?
I did not. So and then I did go to Navy Blue though. I forgot to post about them, but like I enjoyed the meal there. And then Marie was there, and she sent me the key lime pie. I was like, oh no, you don't know. That's like a running joke on Instagram. It's just like the key lime pie to me is like a lower tier dessert. not to trigger your folks out there, but I'm like,
no. I will say this very openly. It is never my first choice, but it is also my mother's favorite. So anytime I'm with her and it's on the menu, it's happening whether I want it to or not. So I'm sympathetic to your key lime pie aversion.
It was like, there's a really fire chocolate dessert next to that key lime pie on the menu. I was just like, I'm going to get the chocolate dessert.
Yeah, there's a really good chocolate cake at Andiron too that's worth ordering. A lot of stuff on that menu is worth ordering.
Yeah, very good restaurant. Love it.
Well, Josh, this has been a lot of fun. As you know, before I let you go, we have to play the lightning round. Five easy questions, five short answers. Just say the first thing that comes to mind. Josh DeLeon, what is your favorite ingredient to put in ice cream?
Oreos.
What is the first band you ever saw in concert?
Damn. I went to Warped Tour in 2008. There's a lot of bands. Okay, yeah.
What is your fast food guilty pleasure? It has to come from a restaurant with a drive-thru.
Raising Cane's.
Good answer. Who is your favorite Houston sports figure, past or present?
Hakeem Olajuwon.
And then finally, what is the last TV show you binge watched?
Jury Duty.
All right, Josh, give us the, I think everybody who listens to this podcast already follows you, but give us the website and the social media for Underground Creamery.
Yeah, you can find me at undergroundcreamery.com, at Underground Creamery on Instagram, or at Eats Gone Wild on Instagram. That's the page I post bullshit on, so go follow that too.
All right. Josh, thanks so much.
All right, thanks, Eric.
You can follow me on Instagram, at Eric Sandler. Keep it locked on culturemap.com for all the latest Houston bar and restaurant news. Thanks so much for listening. I'll be back next week.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.